I was raised to believe that the Bible defines good and evil for us within its pages. But when we stop and examine this idea using the Bible, we discover something else. In the Garden of Eden, there were two trees, a tree that would bring life to all who ate of its fruit, and a tree that brought death. And it was the second tree, the tree that resulted in death, that contained the knowledge of good and evil. Have we been deceived by the serpent who is trying to get us to eat of the second tree? Is the Bible really trying to define good and evil for us? Let's take a step back. Let's run an experiment. Instead of seeking to define good and evil, let's instead ask the question of the trees. Let's attempt to define life and death, but to do so, we must first seek it out. So join us as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Hey everybody, welcome to the Derech Chai Experiment, the show where we seek to understand the conflicts of Scripture so that we don't make the same mistakes. The book of Judges is one of the most difficult books to read in the Bible. In the very beginning of the book, when Israel finally put down their arms and settled down to live the lives in the land of promise, they left some of the inhabitants behind. For the reader, it leaves us with that sense of dread similar to the horror movie when you discover that the call from the killer is coming from inside the house. Israel left enemies in their house and did not drive them out. And why did they do this? Because they were tired. Because they had experienced enough warfare. Because some of their enemies seemed too strong to overcome. And so they just let them stay, and they lived among them. Some of these enemies they made into slaves to serve them. Some they made into neighbors to live among peacefully. And some remained enemies, always ready to strike should Israel show weakness. But God had given them the land, so it should work out, right? Right? Unfortunately, before the action even begins in the book, the angel of the Lord appeared and told the people of Israel that because they had left the conquest uncompleted, the inhabitants of the land would become a snare to them. And what did the people do in response to this? They wept. They cried, but did they change? No. They simply said, "Oh, well, what can we do?" and went on with their lives. And in the beginning, things were fine. Sure, shortly after Joshua died, they were oppressed by an Aramean king, but God raised up a hero to save them, a man of strength and courage and honor, Othniel. I mean, yeah, he was a Gentile, but he had been there for the conquest and had distinguished himself and had married the daughter of the great Caleb. And Othniel defeated the king and freed Israel from their oppression. But after Othniel died, another oppressor arose against Israel, the king of Moab, who gathered the Ammonites and the Amalekites to help him overpower Israel, and he made them a vassal state. And they succeeded for some time. But then God appointed Ehud, a left-handed man, an underestimated man, sure, but a capable assassin and a capable leader. He killed the Moabite king and then escaped to gather the armies of Ephraim to his side to fight and win Israel's freedom. After him is a man we don't know much about. All we know is that he was a great warrior who was able to fight effectively, even with farming equipment. And after him comes a man and woman team who joined together to fight the scourge of Jabin and Sisera. As they do, they gather together men from the tribes of Zebulun, Naphtali, Ephraim together to fight in the battle that ends up being a complete rout. After Barak passed, it was the king of Midian, joined with the Amalekite, that subjugated Israel by simply outnumbering them and taking what they wanted. And so when Israel cried out to God, he raised up Gideon, the youngest member of the smallest tribe of Manasseh, to deliver Israel. And this time, rather than facing the enemy on the battlefield with an army, Gideon was forced to whittle away his men until he had only 300 remaining to fight the hordes of Midian. It was only after the initial battle had been won that the other tribes were able to participate in the war. Namely, Ephraim did some mop-up of the enemies as they fled from the battle. Then we are told of two other men who don't have any great battles or great renown to their name, but who judged Israel for a time and then passed into history. It can be assumed that these men ruled and kept the peace through political means rather than means of arms, and that they began their time of rule while at relative peace and not while under subjugation from the outside. Then comes Jephthah, a man who was unable to escape his pagan upbringing completely and allowed his past to lead to great tragedy. As we go through this list of judges and the events that we are told of about their time and leadership, we should recognize several things. First, the quality of judges available to Israel declines with each successive judge. This is something we have discussed before. And why does the quality of judges decline? Well, it's because the quality of people populating Israel also declined during this time. The second thing to recognize is that every time that an army is gathered to fight an invader or oppressor, and we are told what tribes participated in the battles for Israel's freedom, Ephraim is present. With Othniel, the tribes involved in freeing Israel simply are not named. With Ehud, after he killed Eglon, Ehud went to Ephraim and raised an army there. Deborah judged in the hill country of Ephraim, and while we don't specifically read of Ephraim participating in the battle in chapter 4, the song in chapter 5 tells of their participation in the war against Sisera and Jabin. With Gideon, after the initial success with the 300, Gideon summons the men of Ephraim to help mop up those fleeing from the battle. And so when the Ammonites took over Gilead, they overcame Gilead and pressed so far that they crossed through Gilead completely and crossed the Jordan and began to distress Ephraim and Judah. Then Jephthah is appointed as judge, and what does he do? He goes to war without Ephraim. Well, apparently Ephraim attached a lot of honor to being involved in all of these winning fights, and so just as with Gideon a few generations earlier, when they encountered Jephthah after the great battles had already been won, Ephraim expresses a problem with the victor. But unlike Gideon, who de-escalated the situation, Jephthah takes another path and escalates. So let's read Judges 12, and let's find out what happens as the final narrative of the story of Jephthah. Judges chapter 12. And the men of Ephraim gathered together and passed over toward Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, "Why did you pass over to fight against the children of Ammon and did not call us to go with you? We are going to burn your house over you with fire." And Jephthah said to them, "My people and I were in a great struggle with the children of Ammon, and when I called you, you did not save me out of their hands. And I saw that you would not save me. Then I took my life in my hands and went over against the children of Ammon, and Adonai gave them into my hand. And why have you come up against me to fight against me?" And Jephthah then gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they had said, "You Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim in the midst of Ephraim, in the midst of Manasseh." And Gilead captured the fords of the Jordan and faced Ephraim. And it came to be when the fugitives from Ephraim said, "Let me pass over," the men of Gilead said to him, "You are an Ephraimite." If he said, "No," then he would say to him, "Please say Shibboleth." And he would say, "Sibboleth," for he was unable to pronounce it right. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. And at that time there fell 42,000 Ephraimites. And Jephthah ruled 6 years, and Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. And after him, Ibzan of Bethlehem ruled Israel. And he came to have 30 sons and 30 daughters. He sent abroad and brought in 30 daughters for his sons. And he ruled Israel 7 years. And Ibzan died and was buried at Bethlehem. And after him, Elon the Zebulunite ruled Israel. And he ruled Israel 10 years. And Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried at Aijalon in the land of Zebulun. And after him, Abdon the son of Hillel the Pirathonite ruled Israel, and he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 young donkeys, and he ruled Israel 8 years, and Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried in Pirathon, in the land of Ephraim, in the mountains of the Amalekites. This is the shortest chapter in the book of Judges, and one of the shortest chapters in all of the Bible. Only 15 verses, and really, it's only the first 6 verses that give us any further insight into the continued leadership of Jephthah after he defeated the Ammonites. And what a story it is. As I read this narrative of the tribe of Ephraim approaching Jephthah after the battle, I'm reminded of a similar event that occurred after Gideon's initial victory in Judges 8. If we'll remember, when Gideon faced off against the hordes of Midian initially, the enemy fought themselves. Then in their rush to escape, they passed through Ephraim, and Gideon summons the warriors of Ephraim to help mop up, and they were able to capture the two heirs of the Midianite and Amalekite kingdoms. So when Ephraim gets bent out of sorts for not being called to assist Gideon in the initial battle, Gideon is able to de-escalate by pointing out that they have received honor in the battle that they were involved in through this capture of these princes. When we get to Jephthah a few generations later, the situation is similar, but oh so different. When Ephraim arrives to confront Jephthah for not calling them to war when he went, their initial accusation includes a threat that is personal. "We will burn your house with fire." This had to be a stinging barb in Jephthah's side, because he had just burned the only person who could carry on his house in any way with fire. Remember, house doesn't only mean domicile in Hebrew, it means extended family, including children and servants. And Jephthah's only family had been his daughter, the only one who could carry on his line for him after he was gone. And it was Jephthah himself who had offered her as a burnt offering to God, though we can safely assume that God wanted nothing to do with this sacrifice, as I covered last week. So when Ephraim threatens to take this action of burning his house with him inside it against Jephthah, he was likely still sore from having done this very action himself. A very real example of talking about something too soon and causing an offense, and things get off to a bad start. And so Jephthah pokes back. When we were being subjugated by the Ammonites, I called for you and you did nothing to help us out. You left us to fight on our own and we lost. And remember from last chapter when the Ammonites had defeated Gilead and they had pressed on and crossed the Jordan and begun to harass Judah, Benjamin, and Ephraim? Ephraim had to be aware in some way of what their failure to support Gilead and what it had cost. I suspect that Ephraim looked at the Ammonite invasion and decided it was unwinnable, and so they opted out of the fight so that they weren't shamed in losing. And when the Ammonites defeated Gilead and pressed even further into Israel, they felt like some sense of justification in their decision. See, the battle was indeed lost. But this way, at least we have troops at home to be able to fight for our own territory, rather than leaving it open by sending them all to lose on your borders. But now that victory had been secured, Ephraim feels slighted because they weren't summoned again to participate in the winning battle. An accusation that they had to know was unjust, and yet it didn't matter. They made it anyway. And I think this highlights an aspect of the character and culture of Ephraim that's not specifically stated. Ephraim took pride in their power and military ability, but now their pride had been damaged through this perceived shame. They had not fought when the battle looked too difficult, and as a result, the battle had come to them. But then when Gilead was able to overcome the Ammonites, their pride and honor and possibly even self-identity was wounded. They felt as if they were the wronged party by not having been included in the victory. And so they come bearing threats against Jephthah and his house after he had won. And after Jephthah's response, Ephraim apparently continued to attack Gilead by disassociating themselves from Gilead. The way that these verses read is not clear, but it seems as if this was the statement that sent Jephthah over the edge. You are fugitives from Ephraim and Manasseh. Unfortunately, there is an issue here. The word fugitive in modern English does not carry the same definition as the word palit that is translated as fugitive here. This word has a range of meaning in modern English, ranging from a fugitive to refugee, because this word simply means a person who has escaped. Both fugitives and refugees are escapees, but their reason for escape is vastly different. Instead, Ephraim is stating that Gilead is in some way less than Ephraim and Manasseh because they settled on the east side of the Jordan. They escaped from Ephraim and Manasseh. In essence, you are not our brothers any longer. You came from us, but you are not us. The wall of division is driven higher, and the people of Gilead's concern that were raised back in Joshua 22 are being realized. Do you remember that? The 2.5 tribes were sent home after the conquest, and on their way home, these tribes stopped in the land of Gilead in order to build a replica altar on the east side of the Jordan. This almost resulted in a war against these tribes until they stated their reasoning. Joshua 22:24-25. No, but we did it from fear that in time to come your children might say to our children, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you. You people of Reuben and people of Gad, you have no portion in the Lord, so your children might make our children cease to worship the Lord. Those who would become known as Gileadites in later generations were worried that the tribes in Canaan would cut them off and not consider them brothers anymore. Well, it's finally happened. The tribe of Ephraim has clearly stated that those of Gilead were escapees from Ephraim and Manasseh. In essence, they were declaring the tribes of Gilead to be cut off from Israel. What started as threats and posturing quickly escalated into tribal warfare. Not truly a civil war, as occurs later in the Book of Kings between Israel, led by Ephraim, and Judah. Instead, two tribes with a grudge against each other decide to face off in battle. And in the battle, Ephraim loses big time. Gilead captures the fords of the Jordan, and while the details are not clear here in the text, one of two things happened. Either the battle was occurring in Gilead, and Gilead captured the escape route for Ephraim. And as men fled from the battle and tried to get home, the Gileadites would slaughter them, turning their own commander's words against them. You are escapees, and so they killed them, as was threatened against Jephthah and the Gileadites. The other option is that after the battle was won, Jephthah pressed into Ephraim to pursue the battle. And so when the people fled to the Jordan to escape the battle, Gilead would kill them out of spite for the words of their commander. Which of these it is, I do not know, but the first leaves Jephthah with at least some honor, as he would have been killing fleeing soldiers and not civilian refugees. Now, the way that the Gileadites test for the person from Ephraim is also interesting, because similar identification techniques have been used in the modern world. For example, if you have seen a movie featuring soldiers in World War II, you have probably seen that when two groups of soldiers would meet, one would yell "Flash," and the other would respond with "Thunder." The reason for this is that native German speakers cannot pronounce the TH sound properly. If the response came back "Thunder," then the Allies knew that an enemy was waiting for them. In fact, in the Battle of the Bulge, English-speaking German troops caused all sorts of problems because the Allied troops grew too reliant upon this method of identification. Likewise, Marines in the Pacific used the word "Lollapalooza" as the part of their sign countersign challenge because native Japanese speakers can't properly pronounce the L sound. Well, this technique of identifying the enemy is not new. The differences in the dialects between the Ephraimites and the Gileadites after 300 years of living on opposite sides of the river led to one not being able to say the sh sound, while the other could only say a s sound. And the same thing occurs between Sephardic and Ashkenazi dialects of Hebrew today. One says Shabbat, the other says Sabbas. Both are correct, as they represent different dialects that formed around the language in different parts of the world. Now, the way that this narrative ends leads some to believe that this process of stopping and questioning refugees by the river led to the deaths of 42,000 individuals, but that's not likely the case. The entire episode of the war with Gilead led to the deaths of 42,000 people from Ephraim. It was a brutal battle, and Ephraim suffered a great loss at the hands of Jephthah. And after Jephthah put Ephraim in their place and solidified, at least for a time, animosity between the people in the land and the tribes on the east side of Jordan, Jephthah then ruled for another 6 years. This chapter then closes with three more judges that we don't know much about. Isban from Bethlehem. This would have made him a Benjamite. Isban was all about making political connections, apparently, as he married his 30 daughters off to men from outside his tribe and brought in 30 women to marry his sons from outside his tribe. Then came Elon from Zebulun, and he ruled 10 years. That's all. And then finally, Abdon. Abdon was apparently rather wealthy, as he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons that he equipped with only the best methods of transportation, namely 70 donkeys. Abdon was also from the town of Pirathon, which leads me to assume that he was an Ephraimite. So this chapter ends with a return of honor for Ephraim. Yeah, they went too far and they claimed too much for themselves and they lost, but they were not cast out and not abandoned. So what can we learn from this chapter? It is such a short chapter, and the only narrative of note is a war that breaks out between two tribes of Israel that occurred because of some perceived insult that turned into real insult that resulted in all-out war and the slaughter of refugees. Well, the issue that we see here is one that's been plaguing the judges for some time. Pride. What was it that caused Ephraim to come and to call out Jephthah in the first place? Pride in their own prowess. An identity of being involved in every victory, and a sense of shame when not called to help in a victorious fight. And Jephthah, in the midst of his grief and his own pride, and now being the ruler of Gilead and having taken care of the invader problem, did not help the situation. And in the end, it came down to a clash of big heads to see whose was the biggest. You see, God had used Ephraim. He had used Ephraim regularly and fairly consistently to be part of his plan of deliverance. They had been involved in every fight to overthrow the oppressors of Israel up to this point. But suddenly Israel was delivered without them, and this became an offense to them. In their pride, they allowed an identity of protector to form, which then descended into hubris and caused them to be the aggressor rather than the protector, which led to their defeat. You see, you can be used by God, and great things can be accomplished through you and by you. You can be used as a healer, a prophet, a counselor, a teacher, or any other thing that God needs to support his body. But this should not become an area of pride in your life, especially to the point where you build an identity as the one who God uses in this way, and then expect that God will always use you or include you in what he's doing. God has many tools to use for his purposes, and you are not something special, even if you are often used by him. Your identity should be found in Yeshua and not in how he uses you. We see Yeshua speak of this in Luke chapter 10, verses 17 through 20. The 72 returned with joy, saying, "Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name." And he said to them, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Behold, I have given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven." In other words, do not take pride in the power that God grants you. Don't form your identity around the power that you have been entrusted with. Satan was given power, and that power led him to pride, and that pride caused him to fall from heaven. Taking pride in how God works through you, specifically you, easily becomes self-importance, and self-importance becomes hubris, and hubris leads to a fall. Ephraim took pride in how God used them, and in their pride they perverted their self-imposed identity and fell before their brothers. We see this happen throughout the church and throughout history. The way to fight this is to take pride in the one who uses broken humans as tools, to take joy only in the promises that he has given us, not in the power that he has bestowed upon us. By placing our pride and joy in that proper place, we will find life. So, Derech Chai, seek life in all that you do. Shalom. Thank you for tuning in to Derech Chai. If this content has blessed you and you would like more, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, and sharing with others. To find out more about what we do and to support this ministry, head over to seeklifesc.com. That's seeklifesc.com. We'll see you again next time as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Shalom.